Hello, and welcome to Lies.com podcast number whatever. As you can tell from the sound, I'm making this podcast from my vehicle again. And this is an indication of a change that's taken place in my personal life in the last week. I have now re-entered the gainfully employed workforce. For the last 5 years or so, I'd been working as an independent consultant, mostly working out of my home. And that consulting business had mainly been with one particular client, which was the same company I'd previously been employed by. So really, for a long time there, I had the best of both worlds. I was able to charge the usurious hourly rate of an independent consultant while basically getting as much work as I could handle without the need to go out and identify new business. But time marches on, and that company has pulled some of that work back in-house, and I think just generally has moved on from being interested in devoting a lot of resources to web development in particular. So that business had turned down a little bit, and I'd replaced it with some new clientele, but facing up to the realities that obtaining new clients and separating those who are actually willing to pay from those who are going to give me a hard time when it comes time to pay my invoices meant that there was a sharp downturn in the income I was generating under the new consulting regime. So I went looking for a job and have now found one with some very good people, and I'm very happy working in the new job. The one major downside of it is that it's in Santa Monica, and I really didn't want to move from my home in Carpinteria, which leaves me with a 70-mile commute each way on a daily basis. So that's how you find me in the car a significant amount of time these days. The commute turns out to be almost exactly an hour and a half each way, which is just a little more than the longest commute I'd ever previously had. It's a lot more mileage, but not so much more time, because I'm able to kind of go a sneaky route against the majority of the traffic. All the sane people with their shorter commutes are going the other way on the freeway, whereas I'm heading out of Santa Barbara when the freeway's clogged heading into Santa Barbara, and heading in through Malibu, which, you know, it gets a little bit busy, but by the time I get there, it's not so bad. So this allows me to avoid the 101 and the 405 freeways, sort of the great arteries coming in from the north and west side of Los Angeles. I sneak around on PCH, going past Barbra Streisand's home and all the other movie stars in Malibu. And in the event I do encounter traffic there, at least I have a very nice view looking out at the ocean. So, today is December 16th, date that's easy for me to remember, since 8 years ago today, I became a father for the second time. Today is my son William's 8th birthday, and he is understandably very excited about it. It's an unfortunate aspect of my taking a new job this week that I'm going to be missing his birthday party that he's having after school today around 1 o'clock. And I do regret that. But I'm hoping to get home somewhat early today so I can spend some quality dad time with him at home on his birthday. And I did get to see him this morning a little bit. He's a funny kid in both conventional senses of the word, and always has been. I remember when he was born, you know, with your first kid, you really don't know what to expect. And that was certainly true of us with Julia, William's older sister. And then with your second kid, you think you know what to expect, and you find out that your expectations are completely wrong, because every kid is completely different. And I suppose if we had a third kid, which, you know, we're certainly not planning on doing, But if we were, I'd probably go into it thinking that, oh, this kid will be completely different as well, and this kid would turn out to be exactly like William or Julia or some combination of the two. I don't know. But in any event, William was completely different from Julia, and that was evident right away. When Julia was born, they put her in the little, I don't know, the little bassinet, whatever you call it, the little cradle that sits in the delivery room, and her legs were pumping. She was like Lance Armstrong in the Tour de France. Her legs were just kicking constantly, and that was the beginning of what has continued pretty much uninterrupted until now. She is just in constant motion for 15 years. She has never slowed down, and that's her personality. It's just how she operates. William was born, and they put him in the bassinet, and, you know, there was the initial crying, just a little bit of crying, and his Apgar scores were fine. He was nice and pink and everything, but he did not sit there and cry. He sat there, and glancing over at him, I realize he's a newborn, and this isn't going on, but what it sure looked like was that he was sitting there studying his surroundings. He was looking out. He was, you know, just focused on all those weird colors and wacky things going on. He was quiet, and he had he had a look of contemplation on his face, sort of like, that last scene in 2001, you know, the star baby looking at the world. That's what William looked like an hour after he was born. And that difference in personality has pretty much continued and developed as both kids have gotten older. You know, and I realize as a parent, it's not good to compare your kids to each other. That, you know, really isn't fair to either one. And I love them both, and they're both wonderful and perfect in their own ways. But it's impossible for me not to be sort of fascinated by the differences that they manifest. And one way in which this confronts me in particular is, you know, as a parent, one of the things I'm almost always trying to do is to gain compliance with some sort of idea of what they should be doing. You know, as a parent, I want them to do A or to not do B. And how do you get a kid to not do the thing they're currently doing, or how do you get them to do the thing they're not currently doing? And just in general terms, with Julia, I found that if she was doing something I didn't want her to do as a young child, it was relatively easy to redirect her. You know, you'd basically just either literally or figuratively, you know, take her by the shoulders and turn her 90 degrees and point her at some new shiny object, and she'd take off after that, you know, leaving whatever the thing was that she was about to destroy unmolested. And with William, it's pretty much the opposite. You know, you turn him 90 degrees, as soon as you let him go, he snaps back to the original thing he was focused on. He maintains a death grip on whatever the subject at hand is. He's very good at concentrating for long periods of time, and always has been, to the extent that it's very difficult if he's doing something you don't want him to do, or if there's something else that you want him to do for whatever reason. It can be very difficult to get him to switch tasks. And overall, I think that's a good thing. A virtue in terms of personality types. At least it's something that I've made a virtue of necessity in my own life, since it's something I share. And I'm in a career, you know, now I'm basically a programmer and web developer, and prior to that was a writer and editor, and those are all careers that benefit from that kind of focus. You know, you get in the flow and you just concentrate on some very detailed task you're performing, and to the exclusion of all else, and time just goes away and you get wrapped up in that task. That's something I've always been able to do and enjoyed doing, and in fact have just done, you know, without it really being an option not to be that way. And I could certainly see William is similar. And Julia has that ability too, though again it's mitigated by this constant motion factor. Just being constantly moving on to some new thing. Although, again, able to concentrate and do outstanding work and whatever it is she's focused on during the time that she is focused on it. I don't think that comparison is really fair, is really doing justice to Julia. And on the off chance that either of my kids ends up listening to this podcast, I I'd certainly say that, that Julia deserves equal time in terms of laying out the things that make her wonderful and special and superior. But this is William's birthday, and a podcast is only so long, so for now it's I'm going to leave that at the focus on William's stick-to-itiveness as a virtue that he has. So, I'm on the road about 3 hours a day of my, you know, by my own choice. I'm not whining about that. But it does represent a challenge in terms of figuring out what to do with that time, and ideally what to do with that time that will not just be entertainment, that won't just be pouring that time down the drain. You know, we're talking about a significant fraction of my life, and it would be nice to know that that time is being used in some productive way. And I think podcasting qualifies on some level. I'm not sure that I would spend my life podcasting and, or even 3 hours a day podcasting and view that as a good expenditure of my time, especially in that I doubt that anybody would actually listen to 3 hours of podcasting of mine every day. But I could see where a podcast a week would be a good thing to do, or at least marginally useful and interesting enough to pass the time. But I'm thinking in terms of, you know, what sorts of audio can I get access to that would be not just entertainment, not just books on tape, although I realize that's really the best current solution given technology today for passing time during a long commute. But I'm thinking, you know, not so much in terms of, say, fiction books on tape, which would be entertaining, but would, I think, leave me just without much to show for it at the end of the at the end of the hours listening. But something more like, you know, nonfiction. What I'd really love is to find some podcasts of things like university lectures, nonfiction books, and listen to that while driving. I could see that being a relatively useful way to spend that time. When I mentioned in Ishar, the multi-user chat environment that I hang out in, or was hanging out in, until starting this new job, pretty much. Eusebius pointed out, hey, learn Chinese, which is something that I gather he would do. I mean, he's been going to Asia for work lately a number of times. But it's not really something that I have a great desire to do. And last night, Linda suggested, well, learn French, because I was reading aloud to her the first book in the Sunday Philosophy Club series from Alexander McCall Smith. This is our latest bedtime reading aloud subject matter. And I came across some phrase in French that one of the characters speaks, and as I'm wont to do, I pronounced it in the as if it were written in the only non-English language I ever learned, which was Spanish. So when someone is pronouncing French as if it were Spanish, the result really is difficult for a person who's actually learned French, which Linda has, to listen to without laughing, which she proceeded to do. And she suggested that, yeah, I should use my drive time to learn French. So maybe that would be a good thing to do. I could certainly do a better job of pronouncing the stray French phrase. And actually, my immediate boss in my new job, Alan or Elaine, I'm not sure what the correct pronunciation is, and there you go again, is French, although he's been in the United States for a number of years and speaks perfect English. But it might be interesting to know some French and to actually have somebody I can try some of it out on who would be amused, in addition to Linda being amused at my attempts at pronouncing things. So I'm still really looking for what I can do in terms of using this drive time more productively. But for now, the occasional podcast and listening to radio seems to be what I've come up with. And after the holidays, if Santa fails to bring me an iPod, I'll probably go out and pick up one of those and see if I can get that installed in the car, or borrow Linda's iPod, which she doesn't use that much these days, and see about getting that adapted in some way to play via the Accord sound system, and then see about what sort of useful podcast to resources there are out there that I could listen to back and forth as I go back and forth to work. turning to a more typical lies.com subject matter, it's funny how with my time being consumed with this drive and this new job and wanting to get some quality family time in during the relatively small amount of time I see them at the beginning and end of the day, I really haven't had time to do much at all in terms of posting to lies.com. And yet I see these stories that really jump out at me as being suitable for lies. One thing was that was in the news this week was the execution of Stanley Tookie Williams in California. And of course the media had a grand old time following Arnold Schwarzenegger's decision to or not to execute him. And his eventual decision not to grant clemency. And it was interesting reading through the written justification that Governor Schwarzenegger offered for not granting clemency. It really turned in large part on the credibility of Williams' continued claims of innocence that apparently, and I didn't research this in great detail, but apparently Williams' appeal for clemency was based on his argument that he had achieved redemption, that during the 20 years or whatever it was that he had spent in prison, he had done good works and written children's books and counseled children not to get involved in gangs, and that this should be viewed as offsetting the crimes he had been convicted of or his association with gangs as a founder of the Crips street gang in L.A. And at the same time, he was continuing to maintain that he was actually innocent of the murders that he was convicted of. And Schwarzenegger cited that several times in his justification for withholding clemency, that he said that the argument that Williams had achieved redemption was incompatible with his continued claims of innocence. And the Schwarzenegger's statement went into detail about why it was that he felt that Williams' claims of innocence were not credible. And it was interesting to me, since I am, as anyone who has followed lies.com is aware, I am fairly willing to accept that any given proposition could well turn out to be untrue. And I have a real problem with the death penalty because of not only the possibility of error on the part of the state in assigning guilt and imposing the death penalty, but to my mind, the certainty, the absolute certainty that the state will err in a certain number of cases when imposing the death penalty, and that the death penalty will be meted out to an innocent victim. And I have a real problem with that. I think under any rational or moral framework that argues that a penalty like death is warranted because of the awful nature of the crimes it's meant to punish, that the state is guilty of precisely that same crime in being willing to invoke, being willing to use a system that is demonstrably going to lead to the execution of innocent people. If killing people is bad, if killing an innocent person is bad, and is so bad that it cries out for an ultimate sanction, then I think it's impossible not to believe, I mean, if you're honest about looking at the evidence, I think it's impossible not to have the opinion that the state is in fact guilty of mass murder, that the state has killed many, many innocent people with no real justification for it, that at least that holds water in my mind. I don't think it's possible to argue both that certain crimes are so terrible that they require death in punishment, and then be willing to excuse the occasional killing of an innocent by the state in order to apply that punishment. I think it just, it's inherently inconsistent. If killing an innocent is so bad, then the state cannot look the other way from doing that itself occasionally and treat that as insignificant or not important enough to justify withholding that sort of punishment. Anyway, this was highlighted in my head. You know, today there was yet another story. I saw this over my cereal this morning, and I don't remember the details. This is sort of the downside of podcasting for my vehicle. I can't sit there and pull these things up on the computer and actually have good sourcing. But it was basically a story about a man who'd been in prison somewhere in the Midwest for 7 years, I want to say, for some long period of time. He'd been sentenced to life in prison for his role in the murder of his, I want to say, mother-in-law and the raping of a 7-year-old girl relative. Anyway, and as a result of DNA testing, it was basically determined recently that, oh, actually, he didn't do it. And in one of these weird sort of Coen Brothers movie plot kind of coincidences, the person falsely accused was actually involved in retrieving a cigarette butt from another convicted rapist in prison whose DNA did match that of a pubic hair found at the scene of the original crime or some such, I don't know. Anyway, the guy's being released. And, you know, it's one of those cases like, oh, gee, sorry about the last 7 years of your life, but we made a mistake and here you go. Now, you know, that's a horrible, horrible thing. But how much more horrible had he been executed? And those who advocate for the death penalty, at least the ones that I've noticed, are fully capable of, I mean, I could totally hear them arguing that, you know, back at 7 years ago, at the time of this guy's trial, that this was a heinous crime, that he was a horrible killer, he'd been convicted by a jury of his peers, whatever sort of appeals he'd had been exhausted, and obviously this person deserved to die and should be executed swiftly and mercilessly, and, you know, and in that case, we probably never would have found the result 7 years later that, oh, actually, he wasn't the right guy. You know, the system is capable of error. The system, in a predictable percentage of cases, actually produces erroneous convictions. And given that, I don't think the state can offer any compelling interest that would justify executing those convicted. And yeah, if that was my loved one, if those were my loved ones who'd been killed, I could very well see myself singing a different tune, that the need for vengeance would drive me to argue for a death penalty for that case. But, you know, society doesn't operate on the basis of those kinds of emotional judgments, and it shouldn't operate on the basis of those kinds of emotional judgments. That's one reason why we have a collective decision-making process, so that you know, a collective wisdom can emerge for how to handle situations like that. And in this case, I think the execution of Tookie Williams, you know, again, getting back to this question of his guilt or innocence and how his continued maintaining of his innocence actually undermined his appeal for clemency because it undercut his claims of redemption. I think it's very interesting that, you know, everything that Schwarzenegger argued in that response turns on the question of whether he really was guilty or not. And the evidence that convicted him, you know, we don't have credible eyewitness test, what I would call credible eyewitness testimony of Tookie Williams actually having been the trigger man in these killings. You know, we have Tookie Williams' own subsequent statements, allegedly at least. You know, we have other people saying, oh, he said to us that he killed these people. And we have testimony of other participants in these two separate crimes, or at least one of these two separate crimes, basically jailhouse informants or, other people who gave testimony in return for possibly, some kind of reduction in their sentence. Again, I don't know all the details, but basically you have criminals testifying against each other as part of making deals with the prosecution. And the physical evidence that in terms of the spent shells having been matched forensically to Tookie Williams' shotgun in the case of one of these two crimes. And, what happened was terrible, and he certainly was, even by his own admission of the sequence of events, was guilty of a terrible crime, a series of terrible crimes. But it does kind of raise a question in my mind. He maintained, until his death, he maintained his innocence of those particular murders. He said, I'm not going, and had to be aware that it was not helping his case, it was not helping his claims of redemption for him to argue that he was innocent of those crimes. So you really have to ask yourself, it's sort of like the standard Sherlock Holmes plot device of the alleged criminal who is, smart enough, who according to the theory of the Lestrades of the world, is smart enough to concoct a false story, but not smart and immoral enough to concoct a false story, but not smart and immoral enough to concoct what would clearly be a better false story than the one that's actually being advanced. And in the case of the Sherlock Holmes stories, this typically turns out to mean that, well, actually the person is just being honest and they're offering this lame defense because it happens to be the truth. And there's, some part of the puzzle that Sherlock has to uncover to show that. Well, in the real world, you don't always have Sherlock to come along and wrap things up tidily in 7,000 words. So, and I think it's certainly possible that Tookie Williams was the shooter in those crimes, and having initially, having at some point made a protestation of innocence, that he then felt like it would undermine his personal credibility or his personal view of himself to admit that he had actually been lying about that. I don't know about that part, but I think it certainly is a possibility that no, what we actually have here is a case where the case against him being based on things like other criminals' testimony and people who certainly had an interest in fingering Williams as the shooter, since the DA was obviously interested in pursuing the greatest possible crime against Williams as a co-founder of the Crips. I mean, he was the big fish they were trying to fry, and which they eventually did, although I guess in California it's more that they injected the fish, they didn't actually fry the fish. But anyway, certainly given the motivation of the various actors involved at the time of the prosecution, I could see the testimony of his fellow criminals being somewhat suspect. And again, the fact that the shotgun shell that was used for some of these killings came from his shotgun doesn't mean he fired it. And it does, on some level, seem a little bit inconsistent for Schwarzenegger and the prosecution and those who advocated executing Williams to argue that he's clever and immoral enough to come up with this false story of redemption, but not at the same time clever and immoral enough to recognize that, hey, if he makes a admission that he actually killed these people, he'd have a better chance of getting off. I think on the face of it, Williams' claim that it was simply the truth that he hadn't killed those people and that he was not willing to lie even if he died for it has to carry a certain weight, given that he, in fact, as it turns out, did die for it. So that's my rant on the death penalty for today. I haven't really ranted about the Bush administration much in this podcast, and I think I may be running out of battery life. So I think I'd better get on to that quickly if I'm going to give the president the lies.com roasting he so richly deserves. There's been a lot in the news lately about the McCain anti-torture amendment, and going back and forth with Bush, the Bush people on that, back and forth with National Security Advisor Hadley. And I don't know, if you've been following, you know, the things I've talked about on Lies.com, the items I've been pointing to on Lies.com over the last few weeks, this issue really just drives me nuts. I think it really, in a nutshell, gets to the heart of what is so, so bad and so wrong about the Bush presidency. That basically the nation's morality is being forced through the extremely narrow little bottleneck of George Bush's moral understanding. And I think he just completely misses the whole point of the fundamental principles that I've always believed the United States actually stands for, or at least the principles that, to the extent the United States has any claim to being special, to representing a move forward in the history of world governments, to the extent it can claim to be aligned with some sort of human progress in how we govern ourselves and the systems we use to come to collective decisions and you know, all the things that you learn about in high school civics classes that make the U.S. so special, he just completely misses and has been not just ignorant of those principles, but actively subverting them with his whole response to the terrorism attacks of 9/11 and his approach to the quote-unquote war on terror. And this torture bill, this issue of seeking to craft an exemption for the CIA, so the CIA can torture people if it wants to, these things, they're just really bugging me. I'm not even sure I can say anything useful about it, because I'm just so... I'm just not objective about it at all. I just think it's horrible, it's evil, it's wrong. And, you know, I've gotten to the point lately where, honestly, I no longer feel that it would be sufficient for George Bush and the people who support him to be removed from power. I'm now of the position that, no, they should actually be removed from power and subjected to things like waterboarding. You know, that's the level I've come to. And like I was saying before with my arguments about capital punishment, you know, I take this personally, and I'm not sure that that leaves me in the best position to devise an appropriate collective response. But at a minimum, I would certainly love to see a wholesale change in Congress at the next midterm elections, and for a Democratic Congress to really get aggressive about uncovering some of this and opposing some of this. But we'll see. We'll see if that happens. I don't have any great faith in the Democratic Party to actually provide leadership on this issue, but it's very bothersome. It's very worrisome to me. It leaves me very unhappy. Anyway, pretty sure I have very little battery life left, so I'm going to conclude this podcast. I want to thank everyone, both of you, or maybe even all three of you. I learned that my father has actually listened to some of my Lies.com podcasts, so I think that brings to three, at least, the number of people who actually listen to them. I want to thank you for listening. This podcast is distributed under the Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. I'm John Callender, and thanks again for listening.